Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome to another edition of Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index. It's Wednesday, the 5th of February, 2020. I'm David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine. And joining me to discuss the latest news and developing stories in the construction sector is my colleague Phil Bishop, who edits our online news. So good morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. And we've got some interesting stories to talk about this week, haven't we?
Well, the three topics I've picked out for us to discuss. The first one was a report that actually came out last Thursday after our last podcast, which is well worth talking about, is this Building Better, Building Beautiful Commission, their report on how to make buildings, new buildings and communities more beautiful. This was, you may remember, the one chaired by Roger Scruton, the well-known philosopher who died just a couple of weeks after the report was finished and just before it was published. The second thing we're going to look at is all these statistics that are going around saying no growth in construction this year. Construction's growing this year. We're booming. We're shrinking. Where are we? Lies, damn lies and statistics. Is there a Boris bounce or is it all a myth? An illusion.
Indeed.
So we're going to try and unpick some of that, but don't expect any answers because if economists can't agree, who are we to know?
Well, absolutely.
The third story, it's not a particularly big story. It's just a passing incident in Bristol where a builder was sent to jail for serial bodging, scamming. It's unclear to what degree he was incompetent and what degree he was crooked, but it's probably a combination of the both. But it's on the back of that, the wider subject of what can be done about to protect consumers from rogue builders or cowboy builders, as they're often called.
Yes. Okay. Well, we'll get on to that in due course. But let's start with beauty. And this is an unusual story, I think, very political in many ways, and perhaps not really at the top of most builders' priority list, I would have thought, which is building beautiful buildings and making our built environment more attractive. Tell us about this report. We know who Roger Scruton was, don't we? He was a philosopher and an academic, a conservative philosopher, I would say, who came into a bit of trouble, didn't he, about a year ago? He was supposed to be...
Well, as soon as he was appointed to this commission, to lead or chair this commission, to do this review of the quality or the aesthetics of building, and he was in the news because soon after, some weekly periodical published an interview ascribing objectionable views to him, and it turned, and immediately all the Tory MPs and ministers said, "Oh, we mustn't be associated with this man." And within days, it appeared that he hadn't said these things at all, and the man had been traduced. I mean, he said many controversial things in his time, but he hadn't said the things ascribed to him. And the quick backtrack, many apologies, and he's back in the job. That was all a bit of a sideshow to the real business of the report, which is now being produced, and it's quite a lengthy thing. It's a couple hundred pages. But essentially, the reason why he was commissioned by the then Secretary of State in November 2018, James Brokenshire was the Secretary of State for Housing and Local Government at the time, there was a feeling that with the house building industry going full pelt, there was an awful lot of stuff going up of questionable aesthetic value that we were not building communities for the long term. And there's a sense that we'd, you know, look back in 50 years' time and see the 20-teens as not exactly a golden age, rather like we look at sort of 60s tower blocks, 60s tower blocks, whereas, you know, other times we look at beautiful Victorian terraced housing, we think, oh, how lovely the Victorian buildings were. And I think there's an idea to hope that we could look back on our current generation of building, and it's specifically housing. It's building in general, but specifically housing, the scope of this report.
What was the main thrust of the report then? Do they say that Who did they say should tackle this problem of ugly buildings and beautify everything?
Well, it's less about the builder with the hard hat, obviously, more about planners, local authorities and architects. And the idea being that although the architects are it for volume house builders, are very much at the beck and call of the house builders. So it is the house builders ultimately who've got the whip hand. But the thinking is we need to incentivize the volume house builders not to put up any old crap in chase of profit, but to put more effort, care and attention into not just the individual building, but into the community that they're building. I live in a village which I consider to be very beautiful, even though not every house is as beautiful as the others. Not every house is a Georgian rectory or a 16th century...
I bet yours is.
mine actually isn't. It's a great...
what a shame.
It's a great... I have a great view from my office window. I'm looking out of a beautiful... It's the best view in the village because you can't see my house from it. That's what you always say about Marsham Street in the olden days. So it's not necessary, I don't think, to have every building beautiful to create a beautiful community. At the flip side, I have a slight problem with... Well, the obvious way to build a beautiful community is to put it on halfway up Helvellyn or in the middle of the Cotswolds or the New Forest. Now, clearly, that's not acceptable either. So the trick is to build a desirable place to live in somewhere that is currently not regarded as particularly beautiful, mm-hmm. which brings us on to your next question, I guess, which is...
Go on.
Well, what is beauty? I mean, what's that all about?
Yeah, who defines it?
Exactly. There are plenty of buildings which you might think are really beautiful and I might think are ugly and vice versa. More
Indeed.
Personally, there are buildings that I myself used to think were really quite the thing. I remember, I would guess it was in the 80s when the... just off the M4, A4, as you drive into London, the Hammersmith Arch, that rugby ball on its side. I don't know if you're familiar with that building, but it's iconic in its day. I think it's shortly before Canary Wharf Towers became the big thing. And when the Hammersmith Arch went up, I thought, that is something. That looks really good. And it wasn't many years longer when I'd completely done a 180 turn on that opinion. And so what may be beautiful to anyone one day may not be the same in 5 years' time. And
well, that's true. But
it's context.
Yes, it is context. And it's also time, I think. You've already pointed out that your opinion can change over time. And I think that as we travel through time, we reassess the past and the values that we held in previous ages and evaluate them in a different way. I mean, look at the hairstyles of the 1980s. When's the last time you had a mullet? Back then, in the 1980s, they were de rigueur. You know, you were very fashionable if you had a footballer's haircut. What we consider to be beautiful or attractive in our own period of time is judged differently by subsequent ages. And I'm sure that people who thought that, for example, Preston bus station, which in fact we featured in the magazine, this issue, was beautiful. Nobody thought it was beautiful at the time, but it's a grade two listed building now and considered to be a very important one. It's almost impossible to define objectively what beauty is. So I think that this is doomed to failure.
Well, I can see two potential outcomes. One would be a committee decides and we end up with a camel or some lowest common denominator determination of beautiful. And then it really does become cookie cutter with no scope for creativity or imagination. The second is that the state just dictates and says, right, this is how we define beauty. And everywhere looks like Poundby. Now,
yes,
I don't know what's your view on Poundby? Are you a Poundby fan?
Well, I feel ambivalent about Poundby, actually, because I think if Poundbury had been an organic entity, Poundbury is this sort of model village in Dorset near Weymouth. I can't remember
Chichester,
where it is.
Dorchester, on the edge of Dorchester, I think.
Dorchester, that's right. Yes, of course. I don't know if it's a brainchild, but it was certainly the pet project of Prince Charles, who, as we all know, has very trenchant views on architecture and the built environment. The idea was that Poundbury would be this new community built along traditional lines. And I can't remember exactly what the principles were, and I wouldn't be able to trot them out even if I did. But it was basically But the critics say that Poundbury is a pastiche, and I think that you can't really argue with that. These are Georgian Queen Anne buildings, which were built in the 1990s. They're not the genuine thing. They are pastiches. I think they look superficially quite nice. And if you compare it to your average new housing development, where all the houses are crammed closely together, and I'm going to get on my old hobby horse again in a minute if I'm not careful. But modern housing developments are often very soulless and very ugly. And Poundbury has a certain amount of variation and variety in it. Not all the houses look the same. Some are big, some are small. Some copy different style periods from previous ones. But it's not the real thing. I think that we should be able to build 21st century developments that look like 21st century developments, because after all, in 100 years' time, when somebody looks at Poundbury, are they going to be confused and think that it was built 300 years ago when in fact it was only built 100 years ago? I don't know.
Well, I think Poundbury would pass a government minister's test for what looks beautiful. I think it is very presentable. Its problem is it wouldn't pass my test of somewhere I'd want to live, because you mentioned some of the soulless modern estates. I think that's a problem with what I feel with Poundbury when I go through there. It has a sense of a fabulous, maybe American, maybe British, university campus or business park yeah. with beautiful buildings, but slightly empty. I mean, it needs a high street or a proper village green with a game of cricket going on if you want to sort of have the full pastoral picture created. But it doesn't quite have the... It just seems like housing. I mean, even though there's a cereal factory as part of it, it doesn't seem to me to have soul that development would.
Well, that's the intangible thing, and you can't build that, because that can only develop through usage. You've been to Poundbury. I haven't. I must admit that I haven't been through it. I've only ever seen photographs of it. And I think if you do go to something like that and you feel like you're in a film set and it isn't a real community, then what's the point, really? Just shifting slightly on that, we mentioned Prince Charles, who, of course, his most famous pronouncement on the built environment was about the Sainsbury wing of the National Gallery on Trafalgar yes. Square. And I can't remember who produced the original design for the Sainsbury wing. It was Nick Grimshaw or Richard Rogers or someone, you know, a very, you know, highly respected and very prestigious architect. And Prince Charles took against it. He thought that the design was ugly, and he said that it was something like an ugly carbuncle on the face of a much-loved friend or something like that. And it caused an uproar, and it divided the industry right down the middle between those who were championing modern sort of forward-thinking architecture and those who said that plonking something modern and angular right in the middle of Trafalgar Square was an insult to all the beautiful Portland stone buildings surrounding it. And what we ended up with, because they actually scrapped the original design, and I can't remember who came up with the final design, it was another one of these pastiches. It's a fake classical facade with pilasters and fluted columns and all this sort of nonsense. And it doesn't fool anybody, I don't think. It doesn't look like the buildings surrounding it. And I don't think that it contributes anything to the environment. So I would probably have gone for the ugly carbuncle job, but there you go. It's a matter of opinion. It is a very subjective issue, isn't it?
And there's no way of knowing how things will bed in and just be accepted. I mean, you mentioned Preston bus station as a case in point, but it wasn't just about this thorny issue of Lord help us having a state determination of beauty, and let's hope they only restrict it to buildings and not to people as well, otherwise we're all in trouble. But one of the more prosaic suggestions they had in this report, which I and a lot of people in the construction industry, I think, also would be very keen to see happen, was reform of the VAT system, because we have this strange
Indeed.
Issue of a VAT on building repairs, refurbishment, maintenance, and so on. And if we want to make our existing, or keep our existing beautiful buildings beautiful, make our existing subpar buildings more beautiful, every encouragement should be given to people to put a new roof on their house or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And I think certainly that's that reform on building maintenance, building repairs, would be a big step in the right direction.
Yes. I think Brian Berry of the Federation of Master Builders, I think, made the remark, didn't he, that there's 20% VAT on repair and maintenance, whereas there's no VAT at all on new builds. So there's an incentive there to knock down the old buildings and replace them with something else, when in actual fact, it would be better to encourage people, as you say, to repair and improve existing buildings.
Well, interesting you mentioned the Federation of Master Builders, because I'm going to be absolutely, I'm not sure whether impartial, but fair in this particular podcast, and support them to the hilt on this point. I'm with them all the way, which is something I might not be saying in 10 or 15 minutes' time.
Okay, shall we move on to our next topic, which is whether or not we're going to experience a Boris bounce? Because there's a lot of disagreement about this. I think there was an IHS market survey on behalf of the Chartered Institute of Purchasing and Supply, which seemed to suggest that things were on the up, and that following the Conservative victory in the general election and the final successfully executed Brexit, things are going to improve. But that's not how everybody feels about it, is it?
There are conflicting surveys, and a lot of it is surveys, forecasts, extrapolation of data. The IHS Market CIPS one you mentioned, it had the headlines that, yay, Boris bounce, everything's getting better, hurrah, hurrah, because things are getting worse more slowly than they were getting worse.
Yes.
That's what that particular, the January survey of purchasing managers in the construction industry were asked, are things better or worse than last month? And on balance, they said, things are getting worse than last month. However,
but more slowly.
however, the way this survey works is they give a score, maximum 100, where 50 represents no change, 50.0, mm-hmm. everything's the same output as the previous month. So any score above 50 is deemed to be, we're growing, things are getting better, and the further away you are above 50, the better things are. Anything below 50, things are getting worse. Now, it's been hovering around below for the past few months, 44 in December, for example, 44.4. And now in January, it's rebounded to 48.4. So the graph is moving up. It's still in negative territory, but it's 48.4 is pretty close to things are only as bad as December. But after things have been moving downwards, it takes quite a lot of positive months to get back to where you were before things started moving downwards, if you see what I mean.
Yes, it's a shame that we can't actually show listeners the graph, actually. There are a couple of graphs.
Well, they're on our website, constructionindex.co.uk. You can see them there.
Indeed they are, yes.
But that was only one report, which I think some people slightly got perhaps a little bit more excited than they should have done. And even I put a positive headline on it because I was getting fed up of writing gloomy ones. But even more bullish, I mean, which is a genuinely stunning set of figures that came out this morning, from the Builders Conference, an organisation which gathers contract data, who's winning what work for contractors. So a trade association for the building companies. And they found that compared to January 2019, the amount of new construction work signed in January 2020, last month, had gone up by a third, 33%. Which is a year-on-year leap of 33%. I mean, it's a huge rise. And the total amount of new business signed in January, 7.8 billion, is nearly a record figure for them. The only time I think it's been higher in my memory was, in recent times anyway, was and probably ever, given construction inflation, was that month, a couple of summers ago, was it, when all the big HS2 contracts were
That's
signed.
That's right, yes. And, it was August before last.
Which was a huge amounts of HS2 work, all signed at once. Now, this is a slight problem with this particular indicator of how things are going. It's great to look at all these contracts being signed, but of those HS2 contracts signed the August before last, as you say, how many of them have actually started? No.
So, yeah, that's true.
And funnily enough, similarly, other contracts work has started on in some way or another, and the contracts may not have been signed. There's lots of sort of pre-construction agreements. So there may be work that's going on now that the Builders Conference haven't told us because they haven't actually had the formal sign-off because they're still doing prep work to work out what the final cost will be to agree the contract in.
But there always have to be caveats on information like this because it's... You're often comparing apples and pears. It's not necessarily...
No, you're comparing apples and table tennis bats. I mean, they're completely different things. But I think as long as the Builders Conference essentially broadly make the same assumptions or however erroneous or liberal they may be, as long as they're consistent, it's still interesting numbers and valuable numbers that they come out with.
Yes.
So it's not absolute. I don't think you should say, well, that means that the industry has grown by 33% year on year, because clearly that's not true. But it's an indicator. And again, it's going to get people thinking, Boris bounce, it's all going good.
But just to jump in there, the Builders Conference monthly figures have been quite interesting because they've been consistent over the last year or so. Roughly speaking, we've had about £4 billion worth of new work let every month. And that compares extremely well to a couple of years ago when, I mean, obviously, we're ignoring the HS2 contracts because they were such an anomaly. You don't get those every month. But the general churn, if you like, of new work has, according to the Builders Conference figures, been consistently high at about at least £4 billion a month for the last year or more. And this is at a time when everybody was wringing their hands and saying, oh, we're going to go down a plug hole after Brexit, if Brexit ever happens, and Brexit uncertainty is putting a hold on various projects. Didn't seem to happen. People were still letting work. Last month's figures were, as you say, truly astonishing, 7.8 billion. But the trend has been positive for the last year, despite all the uncertainty.
You say that it's been consistent, though, the Builders Conference data, and at a nice, encouraging level. But just because the contract is signed doesn't actually necessarily mean that the work's gone ahead in many cases. There have been an awful lot of buildings in Liverpool or Manchester and other places where, investors have lost their shirts, where either the things never happened or they've started and stalled and stopped. And a lot of it is of the private investment in construction. That's what's gone away with, or receded, if not gone away, has been stalled by the political uncertainty. And so there's a difference between orders signed and output down the line. It's a great indicator. You're not going to get output down the line without orders being signed, but you might get orders signed and not the same output down the line.
No, that's true.
And when we're talking about the purchaser survey, that's only as good as the information given by the purchasers. Now, a close relative of mine was not in the construction survey, but was involved as a participant in one of IHS Market, CIPS, other sector surveys for a number of years. Eventually, they just found they were getting I don't know if it was a phone call or an email they got and had to fill something in. And it became a right old drag answering these questions. And they just did it as quickly as possible, in as short word as possible. And I dare say a lot of construction purchasing managers are really giving articulate, considered, meaningful data to the survey compilers. But I don't know how many of them are just going, yeah, it's fine, we're all right. Shrug, carry on, as you were.
Yeah.
So while the PMI, Purchasers Managers Index, is a great finger on the pulse of what's going on, they now call it Construction Total Activity Index, CTA, which haven't really taken off as an acronym yet. While it is seen as a really good indicator across industries and business, I think even that deserves a degree of a cautionary note. It's not necessarily absolute. The one which we haven't mentioned yet, the backdrop to all of this positive news coming out in January, is the forecast from the Construction Products Association, who employ at least two, if not more, professional economists to observe what's going on so that construction product manufacturers you know, the brickmakers know how many bricks to make next year, or window pane manufacturers know how many windows to make, etc., etc. It's important for the business model of their members to know what's happening. And the Construction Products Association forecasts, they're revised each quarter, and they've just gone, as far as I can tell, down and down every time. The latest one, they're saying, this time last year, the Construction Products Association, the manufacturers of building products, reckoned that 2020 construction output would grow by 1.4% and in 2021 by 1.7%. Mm-hmm. 6 months ago, they said, it's not going to be that good. It's going to be 1% and 1.4% in 2020 and 2021. And then now they're saying it's going to fall. Construction output in, this is Great Britain, not Northern Ireland, it's going to fall by 0.3% and then rise just a little bit, 1.2% in 2021. So these are probably the most experienced, switched on forecasters in the construction industry.
Yes.
Not say they get it right, they're economists, they're only, you know, it's only an educated guess. But they're saying that there will be no Boris bounce. It's not going to happen. Not this year anyway. And I don't call a growth of 1.2% next year after a fall this year, I don't call that a bounce at all. That's a trying to climb out of the gutter. It's not that good. And all of their assumptions are based on HS2 happening. Signs are looking better, but we don't yet know that is going to happen.
No. I mean, I think that the two main factors that they cite are political uncertainty, which must be the most important one, and then bad weather, which, of course, as we all know, is a huge influence on output, but there's nothing we can do about it. Political uncertainty is the one we ought to focus on, I suppose.
But bad weather only defers output. I suppose political uncertainty only does too, to a certain extent, although investment can go to another country. But if whatever manufacturer wants to build a new factory, they're not going to say, it's raining, we're not going to build a factory. They're just going to have to wait a day, wait a week, whatever.
Yes,
you know,
yes, that's true.
They're still going to do it.
And I'm probably wrong, actually, to say that we should be focusing on political uncertainty rather than bad weather, because as we all know, the weather's getting worse due to climate change. And of course, that is something that we should be focusing on. And the construction industry is doing its bit to address that as well, isn't it?
Well, that's something we talked about in the last episode, if anyone's
not
tuned into that yet.
So we'll have to wait to see whether Boris bounces or not. It's early days still. But there is another perennial issue that we were going to discuss today, a perennial issue actually, which will touch a lot of consumers, not just people in the industry, and that's the question of rogue builders, or cowboy builders, as they always used to be called. And two of them have been jailed recently, haven't they, for ripping off customers?
Yes, I don't want to dwell too much on the specifics of the case. It was brought by Bristol City Council's trading standards team. But essentially, it was homeowners who'd had extensions done, roofing work done, or more pertinently, half done, money paid and never heard from the people again, and they'd given fake contact details or whatever. This gives an opportunity to talk about the more general point of the perception that some people have that all builders, or too many builders, are crooks and rogues, and that old, oh, that's going to be difficult, you know, sucking air through the seats business. As you and I know, that's far from the case. There are probably as many rogue lawyers, parliamentarians, even doctors we're now learning.
Yes, indeed.
As there are rogue builders. It happens in all walks of life. But what I'm particularly concerned about, and it's an issue which I've written about in the magazine that you edit, mm-hmm. is the industry's response to this. There have been many campaigns to tackle what are called cowboy builders. And it's often been unspecific whether cowboy builders means incompetent builders or crooked builders, because I don't believe they are not the same thing and they shouldn't be treated as the same thing.
No.
There's no point giving sending a crook on a training course. It just may probably make him be a better crook. Whereas if someone's not a very competent builder, if we can give them some training, it make him a better builder and solves the problem.
Yeah.
So the issues that have, the solutions that have been churned up over the years include things like kite mark schemes and trusted trader schemes and TripAdvisor type things for builders, check a trade and all these things where you can say if you've got this badge or that badge, or a lot of trade associations say if they've got our badge, that means that they're sound and solid.
Yes.
Now a lot of the building companies look on envy at the fencer scheme and the gas safe scheme, where, for example, if you want to fit a boiler, do anything with gas, you have to be licensed.
Yes.
And so now the Federation of Master Builders and others, but they've driven it and they've brought a lot of people on board and seem to generate a lot of good support, have modelling themselves on or inspired by the idea of gas safe, saying, well, actually, you know, building's a dangerous business. If you're going to put up a building or put up an extension, double glaze somewhere, you should have to have a license. And they have had some encouragement from government from in these proposals, to the extent that a task force has been set up. It was set up last, I think, autumn it started. It's probably met two or three times. And it is producing a proposal for a licensing scheme for building companies, and not just companies, but also sole traders. Anyone who sells services as a builder, the idea is that they will have to have this license.
So are we talking about everybody from Bob the Builder who lives around the corner to Balfour Beatty who lives everywhere?
If Bob the Builder is a sole trader and I give Mr. Builder a check for £200 to fix the tiles in my bathroom or whatever the minor job may be, he will have to have a license under this proposal.
Mm-hmm.
If he is an employee of Balfour Beatty, no, he won't. It's sole traders. If he's not a business entity, he won't have to. Because people who are employed who are employees of building companies at the grand level, the major contractor level, they already have to have a license of sorts, in effect, which is the construction construction skills certification card. And for that, they have to pass a test, pass a health and safety test, have MVQs and have ongoing training and assessments and so on, and have to have that renewed. So we have in place already a skills scheme for builders.
Yeah.
So we have to ask ourselves, what is the licensing scheme about if it's not about skills? Now, my strong suspicion is that it's, although they say they want to raise up the quality of building, it's actually about driving out competition at the remember the Federation of Master Builders who are driving it, they are SME, small medium sized building firms who might be doing a £5-10 million council local authority building job, or they might be doing a £50,000 domestic extension, for example. So they at the lower end they compete with, or even smaller job, I don't know, but they might at the lower end they compete with the sole traders, who may or may not be VAT registered. And if they're not VAT registered, which they don't have to be if they don't earn above the VAT threshold, will undercut them on price by immediate 20% because they don't have VAT to add on top.
Yes, of course.
Which takes us back to our previous point, where the FNB are absolutely right that VAT on these sort of domestic jobs skews things in all kinds of ways in the wrong direction. To me, the construction license initiative smacks of protectionism and vested interest, and it's just going to create a bureaucracy that we don't need when there are countless bureaucracies who are underfunded already. The Health and Safety Executive to ensure things are done properly, the local trading standards to ensure things are done legally. I don't get it. I'm not on board with that scheme at all.
So don't you think that it would have any beneficial effect on preventing sharp practice at the lower end of the market and people having their drives tarmacked by cowboys and people like that?
I think that very low end, anyone who's hoodwinked, I don't want to say foolish enough, because we can all fall for silly scams, but if you're going to fall for someone who's got a bucket of tarmac going cheap, you're not going to ask to see their license anyway, are you?
No, that's true.
So it's not going to tackle that. Nor is
and
it
playing devil's advocate, you could say that the customers are often complicit to a certain extent because somebody might offer to do them a job, and they won't charge them VAT for it because, you know, cash in hand, and it's easier for everybody. And I'm sure that a lot of private householders will quite happily pay somebody in a wad of £20 notes rather than pay them with a cheque or electronically when it can be traced.
Yes, I dare say that happens, but I think there's an assumption that all these people are VAT registered. And I think an awful lot of sole traders, even though they would get their materials cheaper if they were VAT registered, what they tend to do instead, or some of the ones that I know, is instead of buying the materials themselves, well, they'll go fetch it themselves. They're paying the VAT and they're not claiming the VAT back because they're not VAT registered. Which, as I'm saying, they don't have to be. And the customer is paying for the materials up front. So effectively, yes, they're taking the customer's cash, going down to Deuce's or B&Q or wherever, and buying the materials that way. So the advantage-disadvantage to various parties of the VAT being on building products is bypassed in that regard, if that makes sense.
Yes, I can see that.
But, I mean, you talk about sharp practice. There have been plenty, there are, and there continue to be plenty of examples of sharp practice, incompetence, mistakes that happen at the highest echelons of the construction industry.
Yes.
And there's no way that these companies are not going to get their license. If you look at the companies that have been prosecuted, for example, by the Health and Safety Executive for safety accidents on site, and the FMB say that safety will be enhanced by a licensing scheme, I don't think it would have stopped any of the accidents that the major tier one contractors have been prosecuted for over the past 12 months, 5 years, whatever. There have been many examples of that. I don't think it would have stopped Grenfell Tower being clad in the cladding which helped the fire spread as horrifically as it did. I don't think a builder's license scheme would have stopped the masonry and brickwork falling off that primary school in Edinburgh a couple of years ago, which fortunately happened when there weren't children in the playground. Otherwise, who knows what could have happened. And that was a tier one, top-notch construction company that couldn't even lay some bloody bricks. I just think the idea of making the small builder go through the hassle of applying for a license every 3 to 5 years or whatever, and paying for the privilege of doing so, is just a step that we don't need. Let's get the HSE and let's get local trading standards officers paid.
Where are we at the moment with this then? I mean, it's still under consultation.
This task force was set up, and they meet every 3 months. And their aim is by summer 2021. So we're still talking 18 months away.
Yes.
To produce a report, which is effectively would be a green paper for the government to consult on. That's the timetable that they're working towards. The task force has on it, and I don't know whether it's an active participant or a observer, but has on it someone from the what is currently called the Department for Business Enterprise and Industrial Strategy. Is that what it is? BEI?
Yeah.
Still the DTI to me, I'm afraid. And it looks like it might be going back to being the DTI quite soon as well. But it's got a relatively top civil servant who would be involved in any legislation involved in it. So that indicates some sort of support or interest from government there for what they're doing.
Right.
I just think that anyone who doesn't want more bureaucracy and anyone who thinks that this is just protectionism needs to get on board with what's going on and make themselves heard. Many of the task force members, it seems to me, are very, very capable, diligent, honest, administrative people who are professional trade association functionaries. Not so many of them are actual builders.
No, that's true.
Well, that's about it for this week's Reconstruction podcast. Thank you very much for listening once again to me, Phil Bishop, and my colleague, David Taylor. And we'll see you again next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news every day, visit theconstructionindex.co.uk. You can find the latest issue of the Construction Index magazine in WH Smith, an independent newsagent UK-wide. Use our store locator to find your nearest stockist today at theconstructionindex.co.uk/magazine.